Thank you very much for the invitation today. So I choose the title Algebraic Geometry at the Limits of Perturbative Q of T and Dark Matter in Moduli Spaces in this kind of broad presentation of my research to illustrate like the two poles of my research. On one side, it's quantum field theory, which is one language for physics at the fundamental level. And the other pole of my research are modular spaces. Modular spaces are important in mathematics because they collect geometric objects with varying parameters. And that's a very useful concept because often ensembles of objects carry more structure than individual objects suggest. And this concept is very central in algebraic geometry and algebraic topology and also in geometric group theory. And so I very much care about the interaction between these two domains. And I think it's very fascinating, so all these interactions, because both kind of domains are very rooted quite fundamentally in the respective field. The first part of the talk is going to concern like an application of algebraic geometry, or a subset of algebraic geometry, or new development in algebraic geometry to quantum field theory. And this device is called tropical geometry. So there's information like flowing like from mathematics to quantum field theory. To explain this in a broad context, I'm going to take a bit of a bird's eye perspective and think about quantum field theory as a machine which takes some input. The input is a Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian just comes from the physicists, for instance. Here's an example of one Lagrangian. And the output is usually it's some observables, but in cases where we are not very lucky and this Lagrangian has like very specific symmetries, then the only way to actually get these observables or compute these observables is perturbation theory. So in a way, we can think about quantum field theory then as this machine that takes a Lagrangian and produces these perturbative expansions of these observables. And here I choose to write these perturbative expansions as in terms of some small parameter, say lambda. And these expansions, they can also famously be written in terms of sums over graphs. Each graph is weighted by their automorphism group. And for each graph, we also have an integral, the famous Feynman integral, which is written here in this loop momentum form. So we integrate over copies of space-time. the perturbative Q of T workflow is used with great success in many fields of physics. So most prominently, of course, in particle physics, where it's used to predict scattering experiments at colliders, for instance. It can also be used to make predictions in condensed matter physics. A nice example is percolation theory. And I also contributed to this with my collaborators, mainly Oliver Schnetz, but also with Don Gracie and Mikhail Kompanets, where we computed the critical exponents of the percolation theory phase transition to like a very accurate order. Actually, in some cases, the most accurate predictions of these coefficients. And we used some mathematical properties of these Feynman integrals to perform these computations. This perturbative workflow also turned out to have applications in classical gravity and classical field theory quite recently. And more surprising, it also turns out to have applications to various structures in mathematics. And this is what I'm going to talk about in part two of the talk. For now, let me again look a bit broader at this workflow. So these observables, they are these perturbative expansions. And from the perspective of like practitioners or experimentalists, the clear task is to just evaluate these lower order coefficients of these perturbative expansions. We want the zero order, the first order, and the second order, and so on. And this is very necessary to interpret experimental data. It's also very interesting in particle physics, for instance, where the theory prediction and the experimental measurements, they really have this head-to-head race where the theory is just slightly ahead of the experimental measurements. So it's not like that we are just solving the problem like once and for all, but there's really like this lots of work going on to these evaluations. And it's barely ahead the experiments. So the practical question that is associated to this is here really, what's the value of these coefficients and how can we calculate these coefficients effectively? What's hidden in there, and what I want to suggest is a slightly more abstract question, only slightly more abstract. And the question is, if there's an algorithm to compute these numbers or these coefficients. And so this question is a rhetorical question because you just have to look into a quantum field theory textbook and you find in one way or another a description of such an algorithm. So it's of course there's an algorithm. But associated to this is of course the next question, what's the fastest algorithm to evaluate these coefficients? And then we may ask about the computational complexity of this fastest algorithm. And yeah, I think this is like a very relevant question. And to illustrate this, I'm also giving like more theoretical motivation now, which I want to sketch a bit. So the computational complexity of these coefficients, namely, as I argue, gives a quite explicit limit of our understanding of nature. And yeah, so to illustrate this, I have some example, which is a bit flawed, of course, but I want to give it anyway. Namely, that you can think of like some quantum field theory prediction. The example is the muon g minus 2 value, which is a certain number that you can compute using this perturbative approach. And it's one of the most accurate predictions in theoretical physics. And the question is then, how many digits of these numbers do we get if you like employ like all of Earth's computers for 1 year, for 10 years, or for a lifetime? And so this is one way to phrase the question. And another equivalent way to phrase the question is, what scales better? Theoretical prediction of these kind of values or experimental measurement? So what's more expensive? So are the computers eventually more expensive, or are the colliders or the measurement devices more expensive? The surprising thing here is that it doesn't look very good for theoretical predictions, actually. So that you can see quite immediately, and I'm illustrating this here, that if you just use this perturbative workflow, so we write these coefficients as these expansions, and each coefficient can be written for Feynman maps with the Feynman integrals, then you immediately find that the scaling or the runtime to evaluate these higher order coefficients, it scales with the factorial, with the factorial term, so this n plus k. The k is some constant, and it's modulated by some exponential, c to the power of n. And this encodes the number of Feynman graphs at n loops. So it's pretty easy to calculate this number of Feynman graphs. And the dominant scaling is really this factorial modulated by an exponential. And there you can also already see that the scaling for the computations of these coefficients is very bad. So it's super exponential scaling, which is of course horrible. And it's very hard to, I don't know, or probably easy to design experiments that like cost only polynomial amounts of money for your computations. What's interesting here is this other part, which is the runtime to evaluate a single Feynman integral. So we want to evaluate these coefficients up here. And this is kind of not so easy to answer, like what's this runtime? And this is where my contribution also lies. To explain this briefly, why this is actually a problem, so these Feynman integrals here written again in this loop momentum form, they are just integrals. So if you are a student learning about quantum field theory, you might very justified ask yourself, what's the big deal about these integrals? Why can't you just plug them into like a computer, type and integrate and evaluate the integral once and for all? And everybody can go home and doesn't need to worry about like complicated functions and polylogs and so on. Complicated. And the problem with this is that this does not work. So evaluating these integrals here turns out to be a very complicated, but also very interesting algebraic geometric problem. And just to illustrate this briefly, or one reason why this is so complicated, is it can be seen as follows. Maybe we can rewrite these integrals in a different representation, the so-called Feynman parametric representation, where we integrate over a simplex. So we don't integrate over space-time anymore, but over a compact domain, which is a simplex. Here in these alpha parameters, it's of dimension e minus 1, where e is the number of edges of the graph. And the integrand is this rational function in certain polynomials, nu and f. And the differential form, the volume form, is the standard volume form induced on this simplex. And the reason now why it's complicated to evaluate such integrals is that the vanishing locus of these polynomials, the u and f, they vanish if you go to the boundary of the integration domain, so the boundary of the simplex. So they are complicated poles on the boundary. And these poles, they respect as kind of a, there's a complicated hierarchy of these poles. And it's impossible for tools like Mathematica to understand the complicated hierarchy of these poles once these integrals reach a certain complexity, which is not very so which happens at not very high loop level. In one of my works, I formulated a fast algorithm for the evaluation of these kind of integrals. It actually works on slightly more general integrals that are integrals over rational functions. So P and Q are polynomials in such alpha parameters. And the theorem is, or the result is of this work, that if these polynomials P and Q, they fulfill a certain property, then there's a fast algorithm to evaluate them. And the property is that the Newton polytopes of P and Q, they are generalized permutahedra, which are very interesting specific polytopes. And the statement here is that then there's an algorithm that scales exponentially in some pre-processing step, and then proportional to the time it takes to evaluate the integrand times delta to the power of minus 2, where delta is the relative accuracy that we want to achieve for the evaluation. So Mn is the runtime in which we can evaluate this rational function. And for Feynman integrals, it turns out that this property is fulfilled, this generalized permutahedron property. And this runtime to evaluate this rational function is actually a polynomial. So there's only an exponential time pre-processing part and a polynomial sampling part for the evaluation. The critical technique that is used there is this tropical geometry. And I want to briefly illustrate the philosophy of this tropical geometry. It's a degeneration technique in algebraic geometry, which takes kind of a smooth algebraic object and deforms it into another object which is not smooth anymore. So it sacrifices smoothness, but we want to win some simplicity in doing this deformation. So we exchange smoothness for simplicity. And this limiting object then can or should be able to be accessible entirely by combinatorial means. In this example, so the technology used here for these integrals, this rational integral with, over these rational functions just becomes the volume of a certain polytope. And this is then used together with properties of these generalized permatohedra to get a fast evaluation algorithm for these kind of integrals. And these properties, they fortunately have been developed quite recently by mathematicians, mainly by Posnikov, who started the theory of generalized permatohedra in 2008. And later there was a very influential paper by Adia, Federico Adia and Aguirre, on these generalized permatohedra and their properties and their connections to convex object theory. And it's really kind of that boost to forms that are enormous were invented by Sir Jacks now in combinatorics. So generalized permatohedra are... here's a cartoon example on how this tropicalization works. So we can think about this kind of complicated transcendental object, which is defined by this polynomial. It's a circle. It's of course not so complicated for us, but you can say, okay, the volume that is surrounded by the circle is a transcendental number. It's pi. So for, if you are a computer, that might be very complicated for you because you need infinitely many digits to store this number. And the tropical version in this kind of a sense that is used here, in this sense, that this circle is deformed to a square, and the square only has a rational volume, an integer volume, even in this sense. And there's a well-defined algebraic procedure behind that that, that deforms these polynomials in this way. So in this sense, this numerical integration of these Feynman integrals is reduced entirely to some combinatorial task on certain polytopes. All right. And yeah, so one feature of this approach is also that this evaluation algorithm at its heart, it's very simple. So here's just to illustrate a listing like from this algorithm. So they are just six or I mean with some loops and so on. A couple of steps you have to teach your computer. These are very simple steps. It's very easy to implement, and this lies at the heart of this algorithm, and I call it tropical sampling, because you have to sample points from a specific polytope. So this improves traditional methods for these Feynman integrals a lot. So this method is the fastest evaluation algorithm for these integrals to date. And so for instance, previous naive methods, they worked up to around three loops. But with the tropical-based methods, you can go to another order of magnitude. So it's still constrained because of this exponential runtime and this pre-processing step. But it only kicks in at around 20 loops or 30 edges about. Theoretically, also very interesting is that this runtime question can then be answered very definitely for this, for these kind of algorithms, and that they are easy to implement. And that's why also there's like lots of interest from various communities, from mathematics, from physics, of course, and but also from applied mathematics. And you can access new regimes in perturbation theory using this approach. So you can really go very high in the perturbative expansion and then look into, for instance, the large order behavior of perturbative quantum field theory, which is very interesting because, for instance, in quantum mechanics, study of this large order behavior by Bender and Wu, they led to like a very interesting ping-pong play between non-perturbative phenomena and these large order expansions. And I also worked a bit on this with a subset of my co-authors, David Broadhurst, Jared Dunn, and Max Meinig. And also there are various possible extensions of this approach. So for instance, I extended this with my collaborators, Anna-Laura Sattelberger, Bernd Stumpfels, and Simon Thelen, to integrals on toric varieties, which are more complicated algebraic objects. And we also applied this to tackle some questions in Bayesian statistics in this work. And then on the physics side, there's also an extension where the integrals are actually allowed to also have like certain Minkowski space type singularities, so certain IR singularities are included. There are also many other applications. I want to emphasize here a very recent application by Brown and Schnetz, who used this tropical Feynman integral evaluation approach to actually show that certain cohomology classes in the in a group in GLNZ exist. So this is a very pure mathematical endeavor. And it's kind of fun or nice. I really like this kind of ping pong play between mathematics and physics. So this is actually a physics application. But then it again has applications also in pure mathematics. For me, like very important open questions around this are if there's really a polynomial time algorithm for these Feynman integrals. So if we can somehow get rid of this exponential time dependence of this algorithm. So here, this is specific for Feynman graphs. N is the number of edges, and delta is the scaling in the relative accuracy. And this n cubed comes from the evaluation of these kind of integrands in these Feynman integrals. What's like very promising there is, for instance, just as a side remark, that this bottleneck here that causes this n cube is a problem that is very much studied in computer science. It's the solution of a Laplacian equation system. And there are fantastically fast algorithms for these kind of theoretical algorithms. I don't know if they are implementable. But this is like the forefront of computer science, of algorithms in computer science, where people thought a lot about how to solve these Laplacian equation systems. And these lie there at the bottleneck. So if one used like these theoretical algorithms, which I don't know if they are implementable actually, then you get a linear scaling in the number of edges. So it's like, or almost, so it's not quite a linear, so they are like log correction terms, but yeah. These are these Spielmann and Tang Laplacian solver algorithms. Yeah. There's also a more ambitious open question connected to this. Sorry, the question?
Is the preprocessing sort of theory dependent, or can you do it for all theories?
It's only, so you have to project the Feynman integral to a scalar integral. So that makes it effectively theory dependent. So you have to do it, yeah. I mean, yeah, so it depends on how you see it. You have to reduce it to a scalar integral, and then you can evaluate it for a single graph once and for all.
So this preprocessing, not just the denominators.
The numerators, yeah, you can also include them. It's not really implemented yet to include them. But or what do you mean with the numerators?
No, it's saying the opposite. So the numerators are the ones that I guess depend more sensitively.
Yeah, so these have to be determined, like, and they are very theory dependent, right?
But do the preprocessing, does it use the numerators?
So in the current implementation, no. You should use it, and you could also use it in principle, but then, yeah, it's again theory dependent, right? Yeah.
So not using it can be better in a sense, because
The problem is that you have to do it then to every term in the numerator one by one. So you can do it like, so at the moment it's only like monomial wise in the numerator. So you have to split it into all the terms from the numerator. That adds to the complexity. It would be better to just do it like once, like to just not break the numerator apart. This is also on the to-do list there, right? So there's like lots of extensions like this one, for instance, where one should really exploit like the structure of specific numerators that come from specific quantum field theories. This is not done yet. But these kind of more broader open questions, so this open question here about the improvements of this sampling algorithm, it suggests also a more ambitious open question namely, I mean, this is very ambitious here, but the question if there's a polynomial time algorithm or at least a faster algorithm for the evaluation of these amplitudes in quantum field theory. So the state of the art scaling, as I illustrated before, it comes from the number of these Feynman graphs, which scales exponentially times a factorial term, times the time it takes to evaluate a single Feynman integral. And the dominant term, of course, is this factorial. And the first question here is, of course, if you can somehow get rid of the factorial factor, which makes the scaling so bad. And the second question is, of course, if we can somehow even reduce it to a polynomial time scaling. Yeah, and there's some hope that something like this can actually be achieved. And I'm not going to talk about this in detail, but promising approach is to extend this tropicalization philosophy to the whole quantum field theory. So to think about, to figure out a way to somehow craft a cartoon version of the whole quantum field theory, which is much simpler than the original quantum field theory, then solve this or integrate this explicitly, and then feedback something to be able to solve the original quantum field theory, at least numerically. But I don't have time to talk about this in detail. Instead, I'm going to talk about applications in the other direction, which I really like, namely applications from quantum field theory to problems in mathematics. And in this case, I have an example for an application in modular space topology. So this is the more mathematical part of the talk. And my favorite modular space is the modular space of graphs. And I'm briefly going to explain like what this modular space is. And I'm even going to start with some motivation from physics, which is kind of a suggestion why, as a physicist, one could also invent this modular space from the perspective of these perturbative expansions. So remember that we have these coefficients in quantum field theory that in this cartoon picture, of course, are roughly sums over graphs. Each graph is weighted by its symmetry factor, its order of the automorphism group. And then we can plug in this Feynman parameter representation for the Feynman integral, where we integrate over a simplex for each graph. And what we can then do is we can take the sum and the simplices and just think about, together with this automorphism acting on the whole thing, think about it as a single integral of a new space. And this might lead you to like an invention of the modular space of graphs, where all these graphs are glued together in a single space. So we can think about these coefficients as one single integral over this modular space with some differential form that depends on the respective graph and it boils down to these U and F and N polynomials. Here's a more formal definition of this modular space. I will change notation here from the root number from n to g. Sorry about that. G is more traditional in this modular space literature as an index, as it refers also to the genus. So mgg is the modular space of graphs with g loops. And each point in MGG is some metric graph. So it's a pair of a graph and a metric on the graph. The graph is required to fulfill certain properties. So it has G loops. And the vertex degree is strictly larger than, is weakly larger than 3. And this metric is just a function that assigns a length to each edge of the graph. And we want to choose this length scale to avoid like a trivial symmetry. We choose it such that the total volume or the total length of the graph is 1. And we also restrict that there are no cycles in our graphs of length zero, which is an important restriction. And then there are two identifications. So we identify points where we have an edge of length zero in our graph with the respective graph where the edge is contracted. And we also identify metric graphs up to isometry. So this is a bit dry, so I also included like a picture to illustrate this by example. So this is the modelized space of graphs with two loops. And this modelized space has like two top-dimensional strata, one corresponding here to the theta graph and the other corresponding to the handlebar graph. So I distinguished like here two points in the modelized space. Each point corresponds to this metric graph, which is illustrated here in the blue bubble. And if we move this point, then we continuously change the length of the edges of the graph. So I have this high quality animation here, where we shrink like one of the edges of the graph. And you can see that we can, for instance, go to the boundary of this triangle. And what's going to happen is that we contract one of the edges to a point, and we end up finding this hourglass-shaped graph, this tadpole graph here on the boundary. So these black lines, they are occupied by this hourglass-shaped graph with different lengths on both sides of the tadpole. And this triangle here is occupied by this handlebar graph. There are a couple of other, I forgot to mention that there's because of the symmetry of the graphs, there's a six-fold symmetry in this picture. So these 6 points, they are all identified by mirror and rotation symmetry. And there are other interesting points to discuss here. So for instance, we can take this handlebar graph and shrink one of the tadpoles to zero, but cycles of length zero are not allowed in the space. So we are not allowed to reach this dashed line. The dashed line is not part of the space. And the same holds here if we are shrinking like a subcycle of the graph to a point. So these hollow points, they are also not part of the modular space. So certain points are excluded. There's also a physics analogy here hidden. Namely, if you know about the moduli space of graphs, for instance, of curves, sorry. For instance, you might know about it if you're interested in string theory. This moduli space of curves can be thought of as the configuration space of 2D quantum gravity. And similarly, you can think of the moduli space of graphs as the configuration space of one-dimensional quantum gravity with singularities. So the vertices are then singularities. Why is this modular space interesting? There's a couple of reasons. The first reason is that this modular space of graphs, it's a classifying space for a very interesting group. So it realizes this group as a specific symmetry somehow. And this group is the outer automorphism group of the free group with G generators. So this is a very fundamental group. And this is also why this modular space was invented in the first place by Kaller and Vogtmann in 86. This modular space, so the topology of this modular space also relates to many other interesting objects. For instance, Koncevich related it to the topology of very specific Lie algebras and operats, so more complicated objects from homotopy theory. But there's also like non-pure mathematical relevance. For instance, in the genus zero case, where we also allowed to equip the graphs with legs, then we get modular spaces of trees. And these modular spaces of trees are very popular in the name of more or less based on phylogenetic trees. And they are there also practically very important in computational biology. In quantum field theory, there is a version of such more or less basis in the hidden in the CHY formalism, where it's only about planar trees. And what's also here very interesting is that you can think of this more or less base of graphs as a tropicalization, as a tropical version of the modelized base of curves in a certain sense. And this is also very natural if you know string theory, because there you can also think about this more or less base of graphs as somehow kind of small coupling limit of string theory, and thereby also think about Feynman diagrams appearing like in perturbative quantum field theory. So an interesting property of this modelized basis is its cohomology. And if you don't know what cohomology is, so roughly these, so in this case, in this talk, these HKMGG, these cohomology groups will actually be just vector spaces. So you can think about HKMGG as a vector space which has one basis element for each k-dimensional whole of this modular space of graphs. And you can actually compute the dimensions of these kind of spaces. And these computations have been done up to genus or loop number 7 by Oashi and Bartholdy. In character, these computations, they end up being problems where you have to solve like huge equation systems. And this makes these problems very reminiscent to also IBP reduction problems in quantum field theory and perturbative quantum field theory. And what they found is that there are 4 non-trivial cohomology classes up to genus 7 in the space. There are here also some trivial, so this in dimension 0, this is just trivial. These are spaces that are connected. And then there's another invariant that you can compute from these kind of tables, which is the Euler characteristic. So the Euler characteristic is just the alternating sum over these columns. And it gives you another interesting invariant of these kind of spaces. And in a work of Morita, Sakazai, and Suzuki, they used the representation theory of the symplectic group to compute. So there's a trick also inspired by work from Koncevich, where you can use the representation theory of the symplectic group to compute this Euler characteristic to relatively high genus. And Morita and Sakazai and Suzuki implemented this on a Japanese supercomputer. And they were able to compute this Euler characteristic at least without actually knowing the number here of this class of relative high genus. And they then found this very fun continue the sequence exercise here. So it's like 1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 1. And what's the next number that they found? It's minus 21. And the next number is minus 124. And the number afterwards is minus 1,202. So, and then their computer ran out of steam. So it's they were able to compute it up to genus 11. But what these numbers show, of course, is that starting like from at least genus 9 or loop number 9, there has to be a lot of stuff going on here in this table. And these 4 classes that we know, these 4 things that we know, they give no indication of like where all this stuff is coming from in this kind of table. So so this is very interesting. So behind this question mark, there's lots of non-trivial stuff hiding.
So what is the color?
Yeah, so the color here means that, so this orange, these orange classes, they are conjectured to be part of an infinite family. So there's a actually a deep conjecture by Morita that says that this continues here, like in the slope 2 pattern, there's another class up here. And I think actually it's proven that there's also a class up here in this picture, which I didn't draw. But we don't know if there's more classes there. And continuing, it's just a conjecture that these are actually classes. And then for this green class, it's quite interesting because we know it exists, but there's no explicit formula. They actually have to be many odd classes because it's the alternating sum. And so this proves that they somehow have to hide an odd degree. So these are all. So this infinite family, for instance, it only lives in even degree. So this is why the coloring. What we did with Karen Folkman then last year is that we proved an asymptotic formula for this Euler characteristic. So asymptotically, this Euler characteristic behaves as it's first of all negative, and then it has a constant e to the power of minus 1 over 4, which is kind of mysterious. And then it grows super exponentially, g to the power of g over e, modulated by this g times log g square factor for large g. And this shows that the total dimension of these cohomology groups, it grows very rapidly with g. So there's lots of stuff happening, and the amount of classes in this table actually grows super exponentially, at least like these kind of factors, right?
This is difficult because you're not computing the what we call characteristic.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So this is the proper Euler characteristic, which is really the alternating sum in this table. And this really shows that there's like lots of stuff going on. We also gave like a relatively explicit generating function for these numbers. And we also this thereby answered a couple of questions on this by Koncevich and also Morita and Sakazai and Suzuki. So this relates to a different topic, which is very interesting on this, but I'm not going to talk about it in detail, so-called graph complexes. And this proves that there's like lots of dark matter here. So this is why this is named like dark matter, because you can detect it, you can prove it's there, but you don't know where it's hiding. So I didn't invent this myself. It's Benson Farb who dubbed this, who invented this name. And so this is the dark matter problem in these kind of modular spaces cohomology. So the technology that we used to prove this is like a combinatorial analytic argument, and we relied on earlier results and what Kevin mentioned, that we computed the virtual or the orbifold Euler characteristic of the space. And eventually we showed that the ratio for a large genus or large loop number between the actual and the orbifold Euler characteristic approaches e to the power of minus 1 over 4. This also contradicts in some expectations that the actual and the virtual Euler characteristic should be 1, the ratio should be 1. But this is just an expectation. We used some quantum field theoretical guidance there to do this, because you can write down a generating function of this virtual or orbifold Euler characteristic, like this one here, and then show that this generating function acts as a certain counterterm of a very simple zero-dimensional quantum field theory. And here's the partition function or the path integral for the simple zero-dimensional quantum field theory. So here you see the action is just 1 minus x minus e to the power of x. So it's like a very simple version, maybe, of Liouville theory. There's an anomalous term, x over 2. And then there's these counter terms. And these counter terms are very well poised in the way that the total partition function is renormalized to be 1. So the renormalization condition is just that everything boils down to be trivial afterwards, after we introduce these counter terms. And a semi-classical analysis can then be used to estimate the large order behavior of these coefficients of this generating function here. There are many extensions. Like I already said, you can also think about this modular space of graphs and add legs to your graphs, which is interesting also from the perspective of physics. And with Jos van Mazeren, we showed that there's actually a new stabilization results in the cohomology. Stabilization means that the cohomology eventually becomes independent of some parameter. And this happens here for the number of legs, which is kind of unusual. So the moment where you have sufficiently many legs is actually when the number of legs is larger than the genus. And in this case, the rational cohomology stabilizes, and it stabilizes independently of the dimension of the cohomological degree. And we also showed that this large n stable cohomology is very non-trivial. And here again, we used some technology from physics, namely the computer program called FORM, which is a computer algebra program. With traditional computer algebra, the computations for these kind of things would have been too complicated. So this is really like a nice dedicated computer algebra program there to do these things. There are more applications. So for instance, with Benjamin Brück and Thomas Wilbacher, we extended this and showed that the cohomology of a certain group, the handlebody group, is also large. So the handlebody group is the mapping class group of a handlebody of genus G. And its group cohomology turns out to contain the cohomology of the modular space of graphs, and also as a compactified version of the modular space of stable graphs. And here we used additional technology, which is mainly from a paper by Gessler and Kapranov on modular operators and the so-called Feynman transform, and also related works by John Siracusa and Hino and Peterson earlier this last year. The big open question there is, what generates all this dark matter in this in the cohomology of these spaces? And so one way to kind of approach this is to try to model these cohomologies as state spaces of some physical theory. So that would be fantastic to get like some handle on somehow constructing these kind of classes or explaining that they exist in such abundance. So this was about the modular space of graphs. So I still have some time. I'm still going to talk a bit about the modular space of curves, which is some upcoming work. So the modular space of curves, MG, is maybe more familiar to many of you. Here's still a brief definition. It can be seen as a space of all hyperbolic metrics on a compact, connected, and orientable surface of genus G, and we mod out by isometries. In summary, one can also think about it as the configuration space of two-dimensional spacetimes. Here's again a picture of the modular space of curves of genus 2. Each point can be represented by such a hyperbolic surface. We can actually embed it in 3-space if we require the curvature to be constant. And if we move around, we change the shape of this of the surface somehow. And again, I mean, in general, in this specific case, it's not so complicated. But in general, these modular spaces then have complicated higher dimensional holes in them. So the cohomology is also very interesting of this space. And it turns out that the boundary of this modular space of curves, in a certain sense, has the same topology as a compactified version of this modular space of graphs, so MGG bar. And that was proven recently by Chan Geleshtis and Payne, or applied by Chan Geleshtis and Payne, who proved that the homology of this compactified modular space of graphs, MGG bar, injects into the cohomology of MG. So there's an injection of the homology into the cohomology. Of course, cohomology and homology are ultimately the same because here it's all with rational coefficients. And the image of this map that Chan Geleshtis Payne proved is also explicit. It maps into the top weight part of the cohomology. So there's a weight filtration due to a spectral sequence by Deligne on this cohomology of the modular space of curves. And the top transcendental weight of this cohomology lies in the image of this map. So the top cohomology, the top transcendental weight is isomorphic, is the same as the homology of this modular space of compactified, this compactified modular space of graphs. And this is where sort of an upcoming work of mine starts. The motivating question is then how much of the cohomology in the modular space of curves lives in this top transcendental weight? And you can answer this, or at least give some answer on this question, again by looking at the Euler characteristic of this modular space, this compactified modular space. So this is a different version, different question. And the Euler characteristic of this compactified modular space, if you package it via some trick into a generating function again, there you find that the actual Euler characteristic, not the virtual one, also is described by the partition function of some zero-dimensional quantum field theory. In this case, the QFT has infinitely many fields, so it's more like a matrix model maybe. And these fields, they interact non-trivially with each other. The interaction is hidden because here we have this product of two indices hidden in this exponential here. But it turns out that this partition function can be integrated. And if you do so, you obtain a nice generating function, or a slightly nicer generating function for this Euler characteristic. It's written down here in terms of Bernoulli numbers. So BK is the Bernoulli number. Mu is the Möbius function. And this gives you some analytic handle to compute the Euler characteristic of this compactified modular space. And if you crank this forward and do some asymptotic analysis or some semi-classical analysis of this thing, then you get an asymptotic estimate of this Euler characteristic, which has different behaviors for even or odd genus. In the even genus case, you get an alternating sign and some super exponential behavior, g to the power of g. And in the odd G case, the behavior is much more funky. It's modulated by a sine function, which oscillates heavily. So in the argument of the sine, there's a square root of pi times G. So this is definitely not a multiple of pi very often. And the growth rate is still governed by G to the power of G over 2 for large odd G. It follows from that that the amount of cohomology that lives in this top weight sector in the modular space of curves grows super exponentially with G, depending on the parity of G. We have different growth rates, and these different growth rates are put into context by a classic result of Hara and Sergier, who proved effectively that the total dimension of the modular space of curves grows with g to the power of 2g. So what this result then shows is that there are super exponential amounts of top weight cohomology. So this grows super exponentially. but only a small fraction of the total cohomology, which grows like g to the power of 2g, lives in, actually in this top weight. So there's much more non-top weight cohomology still left over. Okay, so this brings me to my summary. In summary, these physics-inspired methods, they are fantastically effective to solve like also state-of-the-art problems in mathematics. And on the other hand, also current research in algebraic geometry is very applicable to problems in physics. And I hope that I convinced you that this is like a very fascinating connection between very fundamental domains in the respective field. Thank you.
Okay, are there any questions for Michael?
Yeah, so for the case of moduli space of curves, you can write down various generating functions of homological classes, and this satisfies some nice properties of Newton conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
So are there like similar statements for the moduli spaces of graphs?
Yes and no. I mean, there are negative statements because you cannot. So these cohomology classes that you mean, I think, in the moduli space of curves, they are stable cohomology classes. So they live in their relatively small dimension. So these are, for instance, these kappa classes. There's a famous theorem by Madsen and Weiss that has showed that the complete stable cohomology of MG is generated, at least rationally, by these kappa classes. But the analogous theorem for the modular space of graphs was proven by Galatius, showed that there's no stable cohomology. So it's just trivial, in a sense. So there are no such classes there. All the cohomology of the modular space of graphs is unstable, except for one trivial class in dimension zero.
At the beginning, you said like almost, you know, like only vanishingly small amount of the cohomology is in top degree. But from what you told me, like it could have happened that half of it was in top degree and there was some massive.
Doesn't happen? So this is, from the amount of information that I gave you, this is very reasonable to expect this. But because these are computations of Euler, all is based on Euler characteristic computations, and the Euler characteristic is additive. So by proving that if you prove that the Euler characteristic of MG behaves as, I think it's something like this. And if you have chi top MG being something like this, for even G, you know, then you immediately can deduce that sort of chi non-top MG, because the cohomology of MG decomposes as a direct sum of the top and the non-top cohomology. This, because this dominates, of course, it also grows like g to the 2g and alternates the same way. So it's the asymptotically, the non-top completely dominates, has to dominate. Yeah. And then what you can also do is that you can also get an upper bound on the top, on the total cohomology that lives here, just by writing a chain model of this space. And you see that it actually also grows like g to the power of g, because it just scales with the number of graphs.
Okay.
Maybe I can ask a pretty vague question. So let's say I wanted to study like modulized spaces of like 4D complex, like two complex dimensional manifolds. And you have this result where there's this very close relationship between the modulized spaces of like these curves with the modulized spaces of graphs.
Yeah.
So in the 4D context or the two complex dimensional context, what do you expect to show up as an analog of graphs?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about much about the shape of these modular spaces of four manifolds. Yeah. I mean, one can could try to somehow replicate this this Abramovich and et al. Approach to this tropicalization of MG, but yeah, I don't know if that would work like similarly on four manifolds.
Going back to your first half of your talk, like, have you applied the methods to the QCD at all, or is that?
I didn't apply it to QCD. You need to rely on like external workflows in QCD because, for instance, there are these numerators showing up, and there you need to rewrite all your integrals in terms of scalar integrals, but nothing stops you from applying this philosophy or this program even, but I didn't do so. Yeah, it's also a question like which kind of phenomenological thing you were interested in. Then in QCD, because
there's much of it. Maybe you can go further.
Depends. I mean, in some cases, these the constraining thing in these QCD, or in many cases, it's not the amplitudes actually. It's the phase space integrals. So there, so this is only about amplitudes for now. Phase space integrals are then like over lower dimensional space where you also have cuts on your graphs, and you cannot use this parametric representation verbatim anymore. So that makes it more complicated. And also this kind of philosophy doesn't apply directly anymore. But there are ideas. So I'm currently also in contact with people who really do this practically and who want to make QCD predictions with this, where you do something very similar. So so I wrote down this this shape of these, this very cartoonish shape of these Feynman integrals in this propagator form. And usually you want to integrate over these kind of propagators. And many of these concrete problems, they can be formulated, or they are actually formulated as an analogous thing that you want to sample. So you define this here as a measure. And you have some kind of functions, complicated function, that maybe even comes from your experiment, and you want to integrate this complicated function with this measure as kind of a kernel. So you have to produce a machine that samples like from these kind of measures. And you can also do that using this tropical approach. And it's not really sure yet, but that might be very helpful to actually do these concrete predictions in QCD, because this often turns out to be the bottleneck. And at the current states, the computers, they are really like caught up in the singularities of these propagators. So there's like lots of thresholds, so lots of poles here in these integrands. And this can be avoided if you just get like a flat, a democratic sampling from these measures.
Okay, so let's think like a little bit.